So I was noticing in response to this text, a couple of things about St. Lydia's identity. St. Lydia's, on our website, it says, is a LGBTQ affirming community. And we often on Instagram use the hashtag queer church. And since we're in a summer season focused on identity, I wanted to reflect on that reality about how those claims take root in our life as church, as St. Lydia's, in our individual lives, in our life connected to the ELCA, of which we're a part. I noticed our Facebook pages don't say anything about that, and we're convening a summer identity team to think about some of the ways that we say who we are to our various publics, and so we'll talk about that, the Facebook issue together. I want to return to this challenge in our identity as a congregation about being a queer church in a few minutes, but I want to dig into this parable first to till the soil of our imagination. There's two levels I want to dig into a little bit with the parable. First, the face value of the parable itself, and then the overlay of interpretation that we hear Jesus giving his disciples when he explains it. The parable itself, I want to set in the context of poor indentured farmers in first century Palestine. There's been a lot of research on the socioeconomics of first century Palestine and the dynamics of agrarian life. And the typical poor farmer didn't own their land, rented there. They were tenant farmers, indentured servants in a way. And they had to hope for a yield large enough to pay tithes to the temple and tax to the Roman occupiers, to pay a cut of their harvest to whoever owned their land, and then have enough left over both to feed themselves and their family and to save seeds for the next planting season. So pretty challenging to have a harvest that was abundant enough to cover all of the requirements. And this merciless cycle often led to loss of land for those who owned their land. They were forced to sell the land to pay their debts, or to debtor's jail for those who didn't own the land. And this cycle caused consolidation of power and wealth, to which Jesus directly responded with his language of Jubilee, drawing on the ancient Jewish rule that every 7 years the land should rest. And every seven times seven years, all the land should revert back to its original owners, which I view as kind of a radical economic democracy. There's no generational accumulation of wealth that's not just in a cycle redistributed to flatten the wealth equality. And so Jesus preaching this was good news to the poor. It drew these crowds who were coming to listen to him, but it also created the murmuring among the leaders who saw the threat of Jesus preaching this kind of radical message. And it's so interesting, you know, that preaching this very traditional prophetic message from Israel's own history would be so threatening to Jesus' own peers. The power of this parable in its like agricultural context is if the farmers were to yield such a harvest, 100 or 60 or 30 fold, they would get out from under the knee of the oppressors. They could expect to pay off their debts, even purchase their land back. It's an impossible prospect, what Jesus was proclaiming, but it was exactly what his organizing among them was trying to accomplish, what the good soil promised. and that he was inviting them to believe was possible. Not that they would just barely have enough, but they would have life and have it abundantly. So that sort of literal context in the socioeconomic realities of Jesus' time is one level of the parable. And its shocking character is that kind of abundance could be possible. But then there's an overlay of interpretation that we hear Jesus giving his disciples who press him for an explanation. And it's an addition, I think, is likely from the gospel writers, Mark and Matthew, generations later, trying to make this parable available and understandable to their readers or the people hearing their gospel. So they have Jesus explaining that the seed is not literally seed, but it's the word of the gospel, transforming and finding a home in our hearts and lives. And if we believe and enact Jesus liberating and life-giving good news in our lives and communities, then this good soil offers the harvest that he's promising, that God's work in and through us offers the same sort of liberation and freedom, enough, more than enough, abundance for our lives. So on both levels, the sort of literal level of the agricultural parable and then this interpretation of the seed as the word of God, the parable turns on both cases on the shocking promise of the good soil and the impossible harvest, the overwhelming yield, many times more than the best harvest one could imagine coming to be. And I want to take this parable, which could be applied to a lot of aspects of our lives, and explore this particular area where oppression rules and yet where we seek good soil, and listen as Jesus asks us how in our lives, in this particular way, God brings liberating, impossible, affirming, abundant life into our midst. Our seeking to be good soil for queer folks is, it seems to me, one place that we can reflect on this parable and its significance. And I turn to that example because good soil is a reference to organizing and advocacy in the Lutheran Church around these issues. Just about the time St. Lydia's was being organized, about 12 years ago, our eventual denominational partner, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, voted at its churchwide assembly to overturn longstanding rules rejecting same-gender relationships and clergy who were living in same-gender relationships. And Good Soil was an alliance of groups who were working for the full inclusion of LGBTQ persons in the life of the Lutheran Church. And they led the organizing leading up to and during that remarkable convention in Minneapolis. And they accomplished something that was both at the same time a total game changer and a fairly low bar. I mean, on the one hand, it was a game changer because LGBTQ clergy, like one of my pastors who baptized my younger son, Bradley Schmaling, had been kicked off the pastoral roster, and he was able to come back on the roster and is now a pastor in St. Paul, Minnesota. And churches could welcome and bless unions. They weren't allowed to be called marriages according to the rules that were agreed upon. But still, even though those game-changing results came from this, the bar we got across was, I think, pragmatically set low in order to get it passed at all. Just listen to the very brief resolutions that were passed. The first one is an agreed upon offering, basically saying, we'll respect conservative voices who don't agree with us. And it said, resolved that in the implementation of any resolutions on ministry policies, the ELCA commit itself to bear one another's burdens, love the neighbor, and respect the bound consciences of all. So they passed that first, basically to say to the conservatives, listen, you don't have to agree, but the church is going to change. Then the second one is resolved the ELCA commit itself to finding ways to allow congregations that choose to do so to recognize, support, and hold publicly accountable lifelong monogamous same-gender relationships. So an agreement basically to allow gay marriage but not call it that. And then the next one, resolved the ELCA commit itself to finding a way for people in such publicly accountable lifelong monogamous same-gender relationships to serve as rostered leaders in this church. So to allow gay pastors, basically LGBTQ pastors, if they're in that kind of a marriage equivalent relationship. So I feel like we have work to do to really become good soil for the flourishing of all LGBTQIA plus persons, the literal rainbow of gender and sexual identities that exist in the image and likeness of God. In my reflecting on this, being hashtag queer church would need to say a lot more about human sexuality and relationships than we've been able to see, say in the ELCA so far. The church has tried for so long to get out of saying anything helpful about sex. For example, except that it properly takes place within the context of marriage. I wrote a piece for the Lutheran magazine back in 2003, and I argued for the queering of Christian sexuality by learning from our LGBTQ siblings who have, for the most part, not been able to use this same procreative cover for their relationships, instead centering pleasure and consent. And it was important to me to have learned from and continue to learn from a former colleague of mine, Margaret Farley, who teaches Christian ethics and wrote a beautiful book called Just Love. And she argues that we must seek just love that shifts the question, as it's usually put in Christian and Lutheran circles, not worrying about with whom we have sex, but how we have sex, combining a celebration of God's remarkable gift of the body's pleasures with a robust ethics of consent. If we were to need proof of God's desire for our experience of pleasure, we'd need to look no further than the clitoris, whose only purpose that we know of is to provide sexual pleasure. But even just considering the skin, our largest organ, so to speak, it's incredibly responsive and pleasurable to the touch. And in part, for some people, the quarantine has been so hard simply because it's meant that they lack good, loving touch. So as we grow deeper into and more intentional about living our identity, whether it's as radically welcoming or anti-racist, or in this case, as queer church, we rejoice in the gift of knowing Jesus' good news, that God desires that we be seeds planted in good soil, that we live free from rocky soil and thorns of oppressive systems that keep us from thriving, that make of our lives something less than fully human. Instead, God offers us a promise, a seemingly impossible and yet completely liberating and delightful reality, that we're to have lives planted in good soil, delighting in the abundance of all that grows there.